Francis Moore LaPay, along with Diet for a Small Planet, has written a number of other books, including World Hunger, 12 Myths, which is an updated version of an earlier book, World Hunger, 10 Myths, Aid as an Obstacle, and most recently, Betraying the National Interest, in which he makes the argument that foreign assistance programs often end up doing the opposite of what is intended, that is, they create instability instead of fighting it. And her new book, which is due out in the spring, is Rediscovering American Values. She's also the co-founder of the Institute for Food and Development Policy, which is a nonprofit research and education center that focuses on food and agricultural issues, and it is based in San Francisco. In 1981, the Center for Science and the Public Interest selected her for their Nutrition Hall of Fame, calling her one of the foremost teachers on the causes and solutions of the world hunger crisis. In 1982, she received the World Hunger Media Award for the 10th anniversary edition of Diet for a Small Planet. And just last year, she and Food First were awarded the Right Livelihood Award, which is sometimes called the Alternative Nobel Prize. That's an award that's given to individuals for their work in areas such as peace, human rights, disarmament, environment, and so forth. And as we talk, you are certainly invited to be a part of the discussion. We hope that you will. Our telephone number here, 333-9455, toll free in Illinois, 800-222-9455. I'm very glad you can be here.
Thank you. I'm also.
I feel that somehow an hour is scarcely enough to scratch the surface, but perhaps we can start introducing people to some of your ideas and they can go on from there. Maybe you could begin by talking a little bit about this, the place that you started, mm-hmm. some of the ideas in Diet for a Small Planet, and that you have carried on really from there, the ideas of what the root causes of scarcity and hunger are.
Mm-hmm. Well, I began really in the late 60s and the turn of the decade, 1970, and I was very much a child of that era, a product of that era, because, as you know, 1970 was the first Earth Day, and it was the first time that we began to hear about imminent famine that was supposedly the result of people pressing against limited resources, and we were told there's just not enough to go around, and books like Famine 1975 appeared at that time. And I wanted to see for myself how close we were to those limits. And in my own modest study, which I began at that time, I was just hit over the head with the realization that the reality was abundance. The reality was plenty. And yet, millions of people were starving. And so my first goal was simply to tell people the good news, that there was no physical reason why there had to be hunger, certainly not here in the United States, but not even in the countries we call the basket case countries, like a Bangladesh, for example, even though it is very densely populated and overpopulated by many standards. There's no reason that it can't feed itself. In other words, there are 100 million people in that country the size of the state of Wisconsin, and yet their agricultural resources are so rich that they could actually be exporting food. And so this was my first goal, simply to free people from the myth, the disempowering notion that we can't meet human need because of physical scarcity.
Mm-hmm. But then you have to go on asking the question, what is going on? The problem is not scarcity. Then what is it?
Well, we redefine scarcity. Yes, there is a scarcity, but it's not of food or land. It's a scarcity of, in the most shortest way of saying it, a scarcity of democracy. Democracy defined not just in political institutions, but defined in people's genuine, actual capacity to participate in their societies, to share in the power, making decisions in society about how the land is used, how the national budget is spent, etc. So it's at that level that the scarcity exists, and it is very real in every country where there is hunger.
Mm-hmm. And has you, one of the things that you have been very critical of is U.S. efforts in the area of foreign aid. Do you think that somehow we have been misguided and that we haven't done it in the way that could be most productive?
Absolutely. I mean, you see, often foreign aid is criticized by critics for being concerned about the national interest of the donor country. It's often said that, oh, foreign aid is simply an arm of foreign policy and therefore is serving narrow interest of the donor country. Well, from our perspective, it's natural and understandable and unavoidable that a foreign aid policy is to serve the interest of the government. Obviously, a government has to serve the interest of its own people. That's its reason for being. So our criticism is rather that U.S. foreign aid doesn't serve the interest of the American people, nor does it serve the interest of the poor and hungry in the third world. So that it's not justified even on the grounds of, well, at least it serves the national interest of the United States. And what we mean by this is that it's predicated, unfortunately, our foreign aid program, our foreign policy more generally, is predicated on a deep fear of change in the third world, of genuine political and economic change, the kind of shift in power that makes a society more democratic by including more people in making decisions about land use, land ownership, use of the national budget. So our government, unfortunately, sees change as a threat to the interest of America. And this is what we are saying is false, that our future security as Americans actually hinges on very profound changes in the third world that would allow people more access to land, to jobs, to security for themselves. This is ultimately redounds to our benefit. And so if our foreign policy is blocking that change by supporting unrepresentative, often dictatorial governments, then we suffer.
Yeah. Well, taking then a couple of other steps up the ladder here to your most recent interest, and it's all, I think it seems that it is all various steps up the same ladder.
Or peeling off the layers.
Or whatever sort of image like that
right.
that you want to use. I think that it's most interesting now that it seems that we really do have some very important bedrock questions that we need to ask about what our country stands for,
mm-hmm.
and what really should be the relationship between people and government, and what should be the role of government in people's lives, and what should be the role of people in government.
Mm-hmm.
And that, first of all, it's not really a topic of discussion, at least not as it should. And When we're wrestling so much, sometimes when the discussion does take place, with this notion of, well, the founders and what it is that they had in mind, one of the things that you say is that you think that we have, those people who say, well, what we've got to do is rediscover what the founders really had in mind. You say that we've really slipped a long way, and that if the founders could come back today, they probably wouldn't be too happy with what we've done with their country.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly that would be true for some of them. Obviously, there was a genuine debate among our founders about what were the values that we were building our country on. And so it's not quite appropriate ever for us to say our founders as if they had a one unified definition. And what I want to revive is that fundamental dialogue. I think you're right that the whole question of what do we stand for, I think Americans are, many of us feel ourselves very much motivated by values, by a vision. But the problem is that those values, that vision, has been reduced to a set of cliches, flags that get woven, but without the exploration of what do we really mean. And so we get manipulated even against our own interests. So what I want to do is revive that dialogue that was going on. Say Jefferson, for example, who understood very clearly that political democracy, meaning genuine representation, could not withstand concentrated economic power. He understood, and he articulated this very powerfully, that there could not be democracy as long as, if we allowed a few people to control the economic resources, that there was a fundamental contradiction. And therefore, for example, when he was in rural France, I remember this letter he wrote to a friend in America after walking on a country road talking to a single mother who was trying to raise her family with no land of her own. And he wrote back to his friends in America, and he said that because concentrated economic power, ownership, means so much misery as I see it in Europe, he said, legislators, this is a quote from Jefferson, legislators cannot invent too many devices to subdivide property. In other words, he was intent that we keep economic resources, the control of them, very widely dispersed. And I think this insight than you can see in our historical tradition on up through a Franklin Roosevelt, for example, who understood also that without economic security, a people could not be free. They couldn't think for themselves if they didn't have economic security. They would always feel vulnerable to a boss or to threats of a politician unless they felt they had economic security. This is a tradition that I think we have to build on.
Mm-hmm. We have one caller here, and I hope that we'll have some others in our discussion. Francis Moore-LaPay is our guest this morning, and if you'd like to be a part of our talk, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free in Illinois, 800-222-9455. Here is our first caller, line number two. Hello.
Hello. I'm really enjoying the program this morning, and especially because it's around values. It's about values, and I think that that's really basic to the whole problem. I have a separate question, though, and then maybe you all can go back to the question of values. And that is that I heard Francis Moore-LaPay speaking at a conference on the environment called Restoring the Earth, and she made a statement there that I've been thinking about ever since. She said that nature and humanity will be liberated together or not at all, implying that those two issues are tied together, and I think it was the first time I'd heard anybody say that like that. And I wanted to ask her, I think she's trying to tie together all those issues, lack of political power, hunger, environmental degradation, and even rapid population growth, by saying the poor have no power, there is no democracy for them, and they have no economic clout either. I'd like her to try to develop that maybe and explain how those issues are all tied together.
Very challenging question, and it's the goal of my life is to tie these together at this point. Mm-hmm. I think that one way of starting to think about the connection, this notion that humanity and nature will be liberated together or not at all, is to understand the degree to which we have reduced both nature, what we think of as resources, and other people, certainly other cultures, as simply instruments of economic instruments of as mm-hmm. commodities as reduced to a market exchange value. And I think that only when we are able to believe that human beings are capable of developing a value structure in which the market and market exchange values can be reduced simply to tools, simply to mechanisms that can help us create societies but will not be the determinant of how our environment is used and how human beings are used, how human beings can develop. In other words, I think we're at a historic moment in which we are beginning now to see the consequences in terms of human misery, of hunger amidst plenty, and the degradation of the environment with the greenhouse effect, with I believe it's about 100 acres a minute of rainforest being destroyed, that these are all now hitting us, and we realize that it is a logical, in a sense, an inevitable outcome of believing that we could simply reduce everything to market exchange mm-hmm. values and that everything would shake out, not believing that we were capable of developing a value structure and simply using the market to serve that value structure in which human beings and nature are ends in themselves. They are not simply means. They are ends. They have innate worth. And this is the turning point that we must make, humanity must make, mm-hmm. and it is we either will make it or we will destroy ourselves. Mm-hmm. And I was speaking here last night and talked to a lot of young people asking me, well, how can you be so cheerful when there's such bad news? And I guess some of the way I answer that, and your question brings it to mind, is simply that it is quite a privilege, isn't it, to live in a time when the stakes are ultimate. Mm-hmm. And I believe that we, all of us born in the post-World War II era, share that privilege to live in this time of historic awakening. And we either will take that opportunity, mold our lives to face it and to go beyond it, or we will destroy ourselves. And it is up to this generation to make that choice.
Right, right. Okay, thank you very much.
Very good. Thank you for the call. We have someone else here on our toll-free line. There we'll go next. Hello.
Good morning. You were talking about land reform and the problems of reassessing and restructuring a political democracy and that sort of thing. I think probably most of us are most familiar in the past several years of what's been going on in the background in the Philippines and what they have been trying to do. And I was just interested in hearing, since I am a little more familiar with them than I am generally everyone else, how some of your ideas apply to the Philippines and why their land reform program does not seem to be working and various other problems.
The Philippines is a country that our organization has been very, very interested in and involved in for many years. And one of my colleagues, a research analyst in our organization, is a Filipino. We're producing a new book on the Philippines. So I want to try to communicate very briefly what's so important for Americans to understand, that there has not been, unfortunately, a change in the structure of power in that country with the Aquino rise to control the government. It is basically still in the countryside, the same landholders, the same power structure is still existing in the National Assembly. And so with that truth, then it is impossible to imagine that there can be an effective land reform. There has not been a fundamental shift in the representation. In fact, the land reform that was passed is meaningless. It is so restricted in language that it applies to a very small portion of the land, and there's so many loopholes that anyone who has any wits about them can excuse themselves from its meager provisions. And on top of this, the Aquino government has tolerated, in fact condoned, the emergence of even more bloody vigilante groups than existed under Marcos, so that our friends and colleagues living and working in the Philippines see more bloodshed, more violence against anyone who is working to protect the interest of the poor and to advance the interest of those who have no land. So it's the situation is deteriorated, actually, rather than improved. And yet in the American press, often you get the impression that Aquino is a Democrat and that she is concerned about the poor majority. I just wanted to finish, I won't go on, that Philippines is also a testing ground for what now military strategists in the United States call low-intensity conflict, meaning a way to keep the lid on, to keep the rural pressure from the peasants for land reform, to keep that under control without using U.S. troops. And so this is one of the ways of doing this is through increasing the vigilante, the private individual violence against anyone who is working for change.
Well, does there seem to be any hope on the future? Any of her any of the opposition people that we hear about, are they representing anything that could help the situation? Maybe that's the best way to put the question.
Well, I think there's. To be quite frank, my impression is that there's a great deal of soul searching, a great deal of confusion, and among those who are wanting to see real change in that country, and trying to come up with a strategy. And one of the difficulties has been that so many in the Philippines, as well as abroad, have been so confused because the image put forth, the Aquino image, is so positive. And so if you sound critical of her, then it sounds as if you'll never be satisfied, and you're just a naysayer, and you're just negative. And so it puts them in those who are in the opposition, puts them in a very, very difficult position. And I think that I can only hope that they will work through this and come up with a critique that is convincing and can consolidate all the many people who are working through the churches and many grassroots organizations, peasant organizations, organizations of farm workers that have been in the past very well organized and very effective and very dedicated. And I'm hoping that they can see beyond this very difficult moment in Philippine history.
Is the problem with her more of a lack of power or lack of intention, or combination somewhat of both?
Well, I don't know. I'm sure I don't know the answer to that, although one can I've read several critiques of the Aquino performance that have underlined how she did have a time window where she did have a great deal of power during that interim period where she essentially, you know, held sole authority, that she could have made great inroads there into the oligarchy, for want of a better word, that has control. She could have then opened up possibilities for new leadership to come in that was more representative. She could have gotten rid of some of these people who have their grip on the rural power, the land structure. So she didn't use that opportunity, and I think that that says something about her courage, her insights, and of course she is herself, her family, one of the biggest landowners in the Philippines. And so I have to say that she doesn't impress me as someone who has a courage of her convictions.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right. This morning on Focus 580, our guest is Frances Moore LaPay. She is the author of many books, including her first and perhaps best known, Diet for a Small Planet. She is also the co-founder of the Institute for Food and Development Policy based in San Francisco. And we're talking with her this morning about a number of her ideas, including some of those that she talks about in her new book, the one that is coming out in the spring. It's entitled Rediscovering America's Values. Perhaps you have some thoughts of your own you'd like to share, and we invite you to pick up your telephone and give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free in Illinois, 800-222-9455.
Dave, would it be possible for me to give the address of the Institute?
Sure.
Because I also want to say that we have resources such as a grade school curriculum on world hunger, high school curriculum, and a lot of useful materials, very short. We do produce a lot of books on everything from family farming to the debt crisis to the Philippines to American values, but we also have very short pieces that people can use within their own churches, their grassroots organizations, on Central America, many topics. So let me give you the address. It is Food First. That's pretty easy to remember, I hope. Food First, 145 9th Street, San Francisco, California, 94103. And if you write to us at that address, you will get a mailing telling you about our organization and membership and what we publications and other resources we have.
Mm-hmm. All right. Something that I think about is, as I listen to you talk, I think for a long time in this country, we have had the idea that we could do whatever we wanted. And one might argue that, in part, that idea helped get us where we are. That may be a good thing and that may be a bad thing. But it's hard, I think, to buck that, because we can see in the appeals that some politicians make these days that kind of idea that we can do, that we still can do anything we want, has tremendous appeal. Now, others would argue the world is not like that anymore. It's never going to be the kind of world where some people or some country can do whatever they want. We're long past that. But it's difficult, I think, to get people to accept that idea, especially in this country where that seems to be a very bedrock kind of idea. We have a strong isolationist streak in us, I think. And I wonder how you combat that, or at least get people to look at those ideas that they may have, and to start rethinking them.
Well, I think I come at it somewhat differently, in the sense that I think that, at least growing up in the 50s in Texas, the feeling that I got, in fact, I wanted to be a diplomat and save the world through the U.S. State Department as a young woman, the feeling that I had was not so much that we Americans, we thought we could do anything and we can push ourselves around, rather that we thought we had the answers for the world, and we thought we could bring democracy. I wanted to be a diplomat so that I could go into the third world and bring them democracy, because it was so wonderful in America. And so I really do think that, sure, there are people who say, hey, I want to have all of my fancy, resource-costly life, my meat-fed, my grain-fed meat, my Cadillacs, and I don't care about the rest of the world. But I think most Americans, that's not what we identify as American. We've identified it as our values, that we have a democratic country, we have a fair country, and we wanted to bring that to other people. So I think that, the shock for us is to realize that that we don't have to offer what we thought we had to offer, because we are, that our concept of democracy and our concept of freedom is lacking, and that maybe our concept that just economic growth in itself, which is what we thought we could bring to the third world. This is when I was in college, it was the idea that we would go and it was W.W. Rostow's Stages of Growth, and we would teach other countries how they can take off into their industrialization process. But now we see that just in my lifetime, for example, here in the United States, that we've increased the real gross domestic product by fourfold since the 40s when I was born. And there are more hungry people today. There are more people in poverty today. And so we've had to begin to question, well, maybe we don't have the answers. We have such growth, and yet we have such terrible suffering in our own country. We have this great agricultural production, but we have 80% of the groundwater wells in Nebraska are contaminated. These are just signs that maybe we don't have the answer for the rest of the world. And I think that that this is the kind of self-reflection that a lot of people are feeling, and that I'm trying to encourage us, because I think that this is the process that has to begin. This is the theme of the Rediscovering America's Values. I don't know if we're talking by each other, but I think I've come at it from a little bit different perspective.
Yeah. Well, we have several other callers here, and I'm about midway through the hour, and I want to talk about upcoming programs. So we'll get right back to the phones in just a minute and talk some more with Francis Moore LePay. This is Focus 580, our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge, and talking with us this morning, Frances Moore LePay. She is the author of a number of books, including Diet for a Small Planet. She is also the co-founder of the Institute for Food and Development Policy, which is based in San Francisco. If you would like to get in on our discussion and share your own thoughts with us, all you need to do is pick up your telephone and call 333-9455, toll-free in Illinois, 800-222-9455. Well, let's go back to the phones here and to our toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Mm-hmm. To your guest, out of all the garbage I think she said this morning, one thing that made a lot of sense to me is that I totally agree with is that our foreign aid handouts do no good whatsoever to the country. Not only do they waste the taxpayers' money, but they are squandered by these tin can republics out in the third world basket cases. We would be better off if we just cut out all the foreign aid handouts and keep the money here at home.
What do you think about that?
Well, I think that we come to similar conclusions in many cases from very different understanding, because we don't think there are basket cases, first of all. We think people can and are solving their own problems. The problem with our foreign aid program is often that it is actually used to shore up, to reinforce a government that is not at all concerned about its own people, and that's the fundamental problem. So I think that I don't know all your reasons, but I think...
Why should we be concerned about their governments, though? They're not concerned about our government.
Well, we can't afford not to be in this world. We live in an absolutely interdependent world today where the security of Americans, whether we're talking about job security or simply peace in the world, can't exist as long as there are maybe 700 million people in the third world who don't even have enough food, much less the other basic necessities of life. And there can be no peace in this world as long as that is true. There can be no constructive world trade as long as the majority of people in many of these countries can't even participate in the market. So our future hinges on their future, and we are very, very materially and in every other way connected to their fate. And we may not see it, but I believe it's very, very true. So if they have repressive governments who are blocking the necessary changes we suffer here in the United States.
Well, there's one thing I disagree with you on here. You made a statement earlier that you listed, say that there's all these myths about world hunger, that the number one problem is that there's not democracy in the third world. That cannot be proven empirically at all. Here we got countries like, on the one hand, the Philippines, Brazil, Peru, whatever, that are widely praised as democracies, but yet I don't see them as being very successful in feeding their own population. Then on the other hand, you have governments that aren't considered democracies, like South Korea, Singapore, Taiwan, which I view as being very successful at feeding their own people. Taiwan produces almost more rice than mainland China. You know, doesn't that sort of throw a monkey in there or throw a wrench in your argument?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it really highlights the importance of our really thinking about what democracy means, that it's not just one measure. I think that one of our problems here in the United States, that we think simply in terms of democracy as a set of political institutions. If someone is elected, like an Aquino is elected, therefore there is democracy in the Philippines. What we're trying to do is to help expand the notion of democracy to mean actually principles that are in place in a society of participation, of actual distribution of power, so that nobody is left completely powerless. And so I think if you, as we're trying to do, to think of democracy not simply in particular political institutions that can disguise the fact that power is still in a very few hands. Think of Central American countries where you have in Guatemala, Cerezo in civilian government, but yet the military basically constrains all of his choices so that he can't carry out a land reform. So we have to think beyond the form to the reality of whether or not power is shared. And this is what I'm talking about. We have to also think about the economic aspects and as well as the political aspects of democracy.
I hope the caller will indulge me, as I have several other callers waiting, and I'd like to go on and move on to some other folks, and we're moving into about our last 15 minutes here. 333-9455, toll-free in Illinois, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers if you'd like to call in. Next person up here is on line number one. Hello. Yes.
Yes. In response to the gentleman that just called, I would like to just say one thing quickly, that perhaps in our missionary zeal to take our own biases about democracy and other principles, we may have impose on those third world nations some things that they were not able to accept. I think in all our foreign aid, we have to start with a sensitivity to the people we're trying to help and to understand that their culture and their goals may not reflect ours. And sometimes that is difficult because, you know, the senses about women's rights and everything may conflict there. I would like to ask Professor Ms. Lupe.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very frustrated at this point. We seem to have made quantum leaps in harnessing technology to go to the moon, for example, yet the problems here on our own Earth, here on our planet, are very critical. And yet I don't see an interest in the young people around here to help resolve these critical problems that we have with our environment and with value systems. Where should we start to resolve this lack of interest?
Well, I have a somewhat different perspective, and maybe it's because I'm so fortunate to be able to visit a lot of campuses and talk to a lot of young people. I sense a great deal of desire to be part of positive change, of solving these problems, of facing them. I was just, for example, in Massachusetts in Amherst night before last and was learning, talking to people there, that just in the last few months, three groups have sprung up at three of the different colleges in the area, focused particularly on the destruction of rainforests and what is the connection between U.S. Consumption and multinational corporations that we support here and the destruction of rainforests. There are so many examples of, certainly here on this campus, so many organizations working on these problems that I can't be discouraged. I see a real quickening of interest in tying together the environmental problems and the political problems of hunger. I also think, though, it's extremely important that we focus much younger, very much on grade school and high school students, and that's why in our organization we've produced curricula for both of these levels and have gotten great response from children in learning about very basics of math and reading by learning about world hunger and what they can do. So I can't be so discouraged, and I hope that you can take heart also by discovering these groups locally.
Thank you. I think I will try to discover them at the University of Illinois, where I'm currently a student now, but an older student.
Because I know those who sponsored my trip here last night, before the speech, we went over to the food co-op here, and there were a lot of people there who were involved in a lot of groups, Central America work, going to Central America, bringing people here, a lot of activities that you can take part in.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Someone else here. We'll go next to line number three for another caller. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes, hello.
Hi, this is Ms. LePay. The image that you have in Chapter 4 of betraying the national interest of the Haitian peasants shaking their machetes at the sky because the helicopters were landing with food is really amazing. I'd like for you to talk about what underlies that in this, the public law 480 that you're talking about, and how the fact that it was 12 years passed before the humanitarian rationale was added to it, and actually it's surplus disposal. And something else that I think that you probably have the anecdote that Thomas Jefferson, his radical land reform that he was proposing, maybe you'll have a chance to loop back to that and offer that to our young conservative who was calling just moments ago.
Well, I'm glad you're reading our book, first of all. The book that you're referring to, of course, is Betraying the National Interest, where we have a chapter on food aid and start it, yes, with this image of the Haitians who are so upset because they produce grain, they produce food, and they understand that the flow of U.S. surplus commodities into their country will undercut their prices that they need. They have to sell their crops in order to gain income to feed their families. So naturally, can you imagine what U.S. farmers would do? Or consider a few years ago when I believe it was Cargill, tried to import soybeans in the United States from Brazil, and U.S. farmers were absolutely outraged and managed to block it. Well, that's the situation the Haitian peasant is in, that certainly if you're a farmer, you know the damage that imports can do to your economy. And this is not just Haiti, of course, but in many parts of the world this has been true. I remember last night talking to someone who'd been in Guatemala and talking to a peasant there who had gone to the market to sell his grain. And the person buying the grain said, I can only give you, say, quetzales, is that what they are in Guatemala? Anyway, the currency. And he said, no, I mean, I can't sell it to you for that because this doesn't even cover my cost of production. I would starve. My family would starve. And he said, well, either you take this, what I offer you, or I will simply, buy my grain from the United States, the imports. And so this imported food then actually disempowers the local peasant. But I want to come back, though, instead of just leaving it there, to come back to the plight of the American farmer, because it's very much connected. As long as the American farmer is told that the survival of American agriculture hinges on more and more exports, then we will constantly be in this position of having to undercut the producer in Africa or in Central America and Haiti. So that we have to take the step here to understand that we've got to solve our own agricultural problem here without exporting it, without exporting our problem to the third world. And we've got to develop an agricultural economy in which we don't have to overproduce and mine our topsoil and grow more and more and more just in order that people can make it in agriculture. And so we've produced a new book at the Institute called Family Farming, A New Economic Vision, that really answers the other side. How do we solve the American farm problem so that we don't have to dump these commodities abroad?
Hmm. Let me, does that get to your question? You want to follow up on that?
Just the fact that a question I was going to ask you, but I read it in your book, was that food aid, the value that we hear, the amount of food aid we're giving, that only like 10% of that is really actually given away in humanitarian fashion, that the rest of it is sold to various governments, and then they resell it at whatever level that they choose, I guess. Or do we have any mm-hmm. any recourse? Do we put strings, those kind of strings, on the food aid that we so-called food aid that we sell to the mm-hmm. various governments?
I'm glad you made that distinction, because I leapt over that, didn't I? That the very small portion of our food aid is emergency relief, is the kind of aid that we all recognize is absolutely vital for people to live, that in emergency situation, refugees and situations. But that is less than 10% of our food aid. Most of it is actually just another form of economic support. In other words, it is offered to governments that the U.S. identifies as its ally, such as El Salvador, for example. And it's just another way of giving economic aid and, in effect, military aid, because it frees up that government then to devote more of its resources to the military, to resisting change in that country. So food aid simply becomes another one of our arms, in a sense, to shore up those governments that the U.S. government thinks is necessary to protect U.S. interests, which what I'm arguing is just the opposite is true.
We have about 10 minutes left. We're talking with Francis Moore LaPay. I have one caller here holding, and we'd invite others, if you'd like to share your own ideas with us, 333-9455, toll-free in Illinois, 800-222-9455. Next here on our toll-free line, we have someone. Hello.
Yeah, how you doing, David?
Good.
I've been talking a while. Been listening now. But, I wanted to talk to you. You were talking earlier about exporting grains overseas. And from what I understand, there's only two or three major corporations that are allowed to export. And this is what I wanted. This leads into the question I have for you. Agriculture in this country, the family farm versus the corporate farm. Do you have any comments on that? What's been going on here?
Well,
you understand what I'm trying to say to you?
Yes, I think so.
I'm coming in sort of the back door here, but don't cut me off. I got some more too, Dave.
Okay.
Okay. I just want to make two points before I get into the corporate versus the family farm. On this food exports, let's get very clear on what our agricultural exports do. Primarily, the exports from the United States to the third world go in the form of feed grains to develop a grain-fed meat industry for a very small slice of people at the top of the society that can afford this modern Western diet.
Who are the two or three major corporations that export the grain? Now, in other words, what I was trying to say to you is that the family farmer, he can't export the stuff. It's got to go through a broker.
Worldwide, there are only a handful of corporations, about six corporations that handle about 90%, between 80% and 90% of all grain traded in the world. The biggest is Cargill, and it is a privately held corporation that I believe the revenues of this one corporation in 1985, I saw this figure, the revenues of Cargill are greater than the gross domestic product of countries as big as Pakistan and Israel and Egypt. I mean, this is one company that has a bigger economy, in other words, than many substantial nations. But That's one very important piece of understanding the world food economy, because when there are so few buyers of raw commodities like grain that handle virtually all of the trade in the world, that gives them tremendous power in terms of ultimately what the prices are that farmers can get. It's what economists call the oligopsony power, when there are very few buyers and many sellers. So this is a very, very important piece of the world food picture. But often when you hear about corporate farming, you hear the response to the criticism, well, America doesn't have corporate farming. We still have family farms. There is a very small percentage of farms that are controlled by the really non-farm corporations.
You've got to be kidding me.
No, but what is happening in America?
Can I ask you something? I hate to butt in on you, but you know, you mentioned Cargill, okay? Through their conglomerate, we know that they control seed manufacturing or seed distribution to the hybrid seed to Guatemala and stuff like that. They went down and gave these people seed for their farms, and they didn't tell them it was hybrid, and they went ahead and planted the stuff. And next year, what they were used to doing was taking and saving part of their crop for seed, but they didn't tell them that this stuff wouldn't reseed itself. In other words, it wouldn't grow again.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
These hybrids, and this is the kind of stuff that's been going on. But can you tell me through the conglomerate, say just with Cargill, how much of the family farm have they bought up in this country?
But see, my point is they don't have to buy up the family farm. That's not the means of control. The means of control is that of the farmer in the United States is that they're, on the one hand, when you go to buy the tractor or the other input you need, there are very few corporations on that side.
Mm-hmm.
That's very tightly controlled sector. And then, as you're pointing out, on the other side, when you get ready to sell, there are very few buyers. That is the means of control. The very concentrated industries on both sides. The farmer squeezed between these powerful ends on both sides.
Well, I tell you, I think they're starting to see a change, you know, and this is why I think that they're going to buy, you know, they're buying more and more.
But you see,
land, because you know the American people are going to demand that more than two or three major corporations will be able to export.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the family farmer, once the family farmer realizes what's been going on, you know, he'll say, well, you know, I want that piece of the market, and the governors like Jim Thompson and a few of the other ones, they'll say, well, my God, you know, we've got export here, and these corporations are keeping the prices low, or they're keeping them high, or they're keeping our production low, so I think these conglomerates are going to start to pick up more and more of the family farms. That's just my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean,
well, you see, I think they're smarter than that. They realize that if they don't own the land, they don't have to take those risks. This is what, for example, in the southern Philippines, this is very parallel to the American farmer. The corporation has discovered that it's better for them not to own the land, leave that risk and all those problems to the local grower. They sign a contract with the grower for a set price, and the grower who owns the land has to take all the problems, and if the crops don't grow, take all the loss, and the corporation is liberated from all of that. They can just reap the profits. So I think that is a strategy that we have to understand, that the control lies in those who market the commodities.
Hmm. We're almost out of time. I got about 3 minutes, and I have one more person I want to include here on our line number one. So let's talk with them. Hello.
Yes.
Yes, go ahead.
Going back to the person who asked for a comparison between, say, Brazil on the one hand and South Korea on the other hand, I'd like to ask her, nobody's perfect in this world, but what countries, what kinds of government, what kinds of economic systems come closest to her ideal?
Well, in Food First, we have a saying, I guess you can say, that what we're looking for are lessons, not models. We very much resist the idea of putting forth out of whole cloth, some model. This is what we all should be striving for. So we're trying to look at for lessons from a variety of countries and within countries, from states, for example. What I would like to do in answering your question, instead of pointing to a particular society and saying they've got all of the pieces, to give you of a couple of examples of the type of approach that we think is constructive. Is that okay? Are you there?
Well, I can't think like that. I have to have concrete examples.
Well, I want to give you examples, but I don't want them to be interpreted as a model of an ideal society. I think this is the greatest problem that often people think, oh, well, we've got to find an example of a perfect society that's got all the pieces together. I think what we need to do is to look to understand what the values are. This is my values approach. Understand the values that we're working on, and then look for examples where we can find positive inspiration. And so I would give you the example of, say, Sweden currently has decided that it's going to reduce pesticide use by 50% in the next 5 years, and is setting out to do that, and setting out to end factory farming. The way that they are going about this, and the reason that it is possible, is because of a farming system in that country, which we think many countries can learn from, which is based on the notion that land is not simply a commodity to be sold to the highest bidder. It is a resource and a treasure for the society, and therefore you have to be a farmer to own farmland, and that you can't sell your land to whomever you want. Yes, it is on the market, but you have to make sure that selling of the land doesn't go simply to make an already large farm even bigger. In other words, land sales are monitored to ensure that a dispersed ownership is maintained. That's one example of looking at putting values first and then adapting economic policy to that value of maintaining family farm agriculture, just like the Nebraskans did in 1983 when they voted to not do away with the market in land, but to say again that you cannot own land if you're a farmland, if you're a non-farm corporation. You can't use the corporate form to own farmland, effectively excluding them. I'm using these as examples of the fundamental theme that I'm talking about, which is, first we decide what means most, what values do we treasure. The value of dispersed ownership is a basis of democracy is one. And therefore, then we adapt the market to serve our values. And this is the theme of my work. And this is, I am looking for examples that can inspire us in this direction.
We will have to leave it at that, as we've simply run out of time. I want to thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
For those people who are interested in finding out more about your work and the activities of the Institute, they can write to you.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. And the address is Food First, 145 9th Street in San Francisco, 94103. And also people might want to be looking for your book, Rediscovering American Values, that should be published in the spring.
Right. Thank you very much for the opportunity. I enjoy the questions.
Thank you.